From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Lawmakers in Lansing may be ready to throw clerks a lifeline as they prepare for an onslaught of absentee ballots to be counted this primary season. Today, we'll get an update. Plus, we talk to the state official thinking most about how Michigan might prepare for an outbreak of coronavirus.
To do things like make sure we may need to close a school if a case comes through a school. We want to make sure everyone knows proper hygiene practices, such as washing their hands and sneezing into their sleeve and staying home if they're sick.
And the music of Detroit. There's a lot more to it than what came out of Motown in the 1960s. We'll explore an incredible wealth of talent our state produced.
That's one thing about Detroit, the competition. It's part of what made Detroit so dynamic and such a phenomenal music mecca.
All that's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, those daily headlines about the new coronavirus stressing you out? We'll be talking to the state's chief medical executive with some facts about what preparedness means in Michigan, why it's important, what to worry about, and what not to worry about. But first, if you heard a gasp out there somewhere today, that was probably Michigan's city and county clerks breathing a huge sigh of relief. State Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey has changed course on a bill offering aid to the clerks. As we've heard on the show in recent weeks, Michigan's election reforms allowing absentee voting on demand for anyone this year have given a way to a lot more early ballots than usual. Our Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta has been following this issue in the legislature and joins us now. Hey, Rick.
Hello.
So the bill in question came from State Senator Ruth Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Republican.
Yep.
And has served as a clerk in her earlier life. And the bill that she proposed would do several things, including allowing clerks to prepare absentee ballots for counting. So they're not verifying signatures and ripping open the envelopes on election night, just counting votes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I remember
is just ready to be processed, to be put into the, they can be taken out of the envelopes, put into the machine and counted. Yeah.
But they'd still be counted in the usual way. Now, last I remember, Mike Shirkey had said he thought the changes she was proposing would not be worth what he called the security risk.
Right.
What changed?
Well, if I could be permitted a weather-related metaphor, there's been a bit of a thaw. Now, it's not all the way there, just that Mike Shirkey went from I am opposed to I'm willing to look at it. And like you said, what changed? What changed is that in the Senate Republican caucus is Ruth Johnson, like you just said, not only a former county clerk, Oakland County, one of the biggest voting jurisdictions in the state, but also the former Michigan Secretary of State, the person who is in charge of overseeing elections statewide. So she's got some clout, some experience in this, and her voice is being heard in the Republican caucus, the majority caucus in the Senate.
Did Shirkey say anything about why in particular he changed his mind, whether it was Ruth Johnson's personage or external factors?
He explained it primarily as Ruth Johnson being heard, but we're all aware that there has been an outcry, especially after, you know, recent experience in Iowa, that this could linger on for a long time and that would look very bad, and it could look very bad if Senate Republicans were seen as standing in the way of administering elections, not just fairly, but efficiently.
If folks hadn't heard prior conversations that we've had about this, again, the concern is if the count takes a lot longer than usual, which if you have thousands and thousands of extra absentee ballots, it may very well do, that mm-hmm. it's just going to be for days before we actually know results. What
right.
happens next?
And we do have thousands and thousands of extra ballots already coming in because Michigan has changed its laws, the result of a ballot drive, a petition drive, to make it easier for people to vote absentee. And we're finding that they are. And so what happens next? Well, we're not all the way there, that Mike Shirkey has gone from absolutely opposed to willing to consider it. And so, you know, the talks will continue. And he has also said, though, that even if the law does change, it doesn't necessarily have to change before the March 10th primary.
Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Rick, thanks so much. I'm sure we'll be back at you about this.
Always a pleasure.
As you do your election prep for the March 10th Michigan primary, you may be aware that voters in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties are being asked to approve a 10-year extension of the millage funding Detroit Institute of Arts. While people from all over visit the museum, those three counties have a very specific financial relationship with the DIA. State Representative Jeff Yarrick says that some of his constituents are skeptical of the need for more funding. Yarrick, a Republican from Richmond, has introduced a bill that would let voters from any community in Macomb County, as well as those in Oakland and Wayne, ask to opt out. And further, if the bill passes, it would let people do so even if his bill does not become law until after the primary. He joins us now for a little bit more conversation on this. Representative Yarrick, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Do you go to the DIA much?
No, I don't.
This is an institution that's not in debt. Its pension plan is in pretty reasonable shape relative to other public institutions that we might mention. It is working.
Thanks to the support of Macomb County taxpayers.
Right, right. Well, it's working on its endowment, although it hasn't hit its goals. What are your concerns about financing it right now?
Almost every community in my district voted no in 2012. I'm already hearing comments about it. I think it's about the fact that this passed typically by the voters in the south half of Macomb County and not by the north half. So we seem to have a pattern where the north end pays for what the south half of the county want. And it just gives communities an opportunity to put up on their own ballot to opt out of the Art Institute Authority.
Do you think this is about the fact that the DIA is in Detroit for the people who say that it should not get further funding?
I really object to trying to take it down that path. The reality is, you know, villages like Armada, for example, have to come up with $5 million to deal with their wastewater treatment center, a little town of a few thousand people. And then yet they're already pulled into a millage to pay for an art institute in Wayne County. Wayne County's not funding the wastewater treatment center in Armada. Why is Armada paying for the DIA in Wayne County?
Is the state not providing money for the wastewater treatment plant?
Well, locally, wastewater treatments are paid locally, but that's their big issue to take care of. And Northern Macomb County has roads and so forth to take care of. I'm looking at my constituents who are saying, hey, maybe they don't want to I have a lot of hardworking residents there, and maybe they don't want to contribute to having a DIA director that's making $450,000 a year.
If the legislature decides that your idea has some merit, are there other things that we might opt out of? Let's say that Ford Field needed a replacement and there were some sort of public vote to levy state dollars or put together a bond package. Should I be able to tap out of that?
I understand you're talking about state dollars versus local. Okay, we're saying this is specific to Oakland, Wayne, and Macomb. Nowhere else in the rest of the state is not paying a millage to the DIA. And this was also supposed to be a 10-year millage.
Right.
For which they're coming to us 3 years early to ask for a renewal. And it's worthwhile also to note, why aren't they coming during a general election and not where on a presidential primary where turnout typically is going to be lower than a general?
Hmm. Do you see any significance to that timing? What's your read on that?
It's well known that a general election is more inclusive of the entire electorate. I mean, turnout is much higher, and it should be on a general.
As taxpayers, there are any number of things that we all pay for, everything from state parks to ethnic cultural centers to, you know, just other kinds of assets like historical sites that may enhance the lives of some but not all Michiganders. Is there any merit in your mind to the idea that there are places that touch enough school kids or enough students or other kind of visitors that they do deserve public funding, even if we ourselves never go visit them?
The issue is Northern Macomb County should have the choice to opt out of the Detroit Institute Authority. And this is a want. It's not a need. Art is not a need. Roads, water, sewer, police, fire, those are basic needs. The DIA is a want. And if communities want to say, look, we don't want to pay a millage for free admission, they should have the opportunity to get out of that village.
What about something like a public university? Would you put that in a want or a need category?
Well, there's all kinds of education that's important, and that's a whole other debate, and we could have a whole conversation about how we fund education.
You're saying that you don't consider that part of necessarily a want or a need, that even if there's a town where none of the graduates in a given year, say, go to the University of Michigan, that it should still be considered something that has enough public good to fund.
I think you're putting words in my mouth.
I'm sorry.
Let's focus on a specific regional. This is a village for the whole state to pay for the DIA. It's for Southeast Michigan to fund the DIA and allowing communities to opt out because they don't feel that they're getting a benefit from it. And so, I mean, I think we already have funding, state funding for education. So education is a little different debate than the DIA.
Could you foresee maybe taking this one step further and allowing certain communities in Michigan to opt in to the circle of counties that fund DIA?
I think, well, the bill actually allows a community who opted out to opt back in at some point if things change. Now, I suppose if there are communities that brought that suggestion and said they wanted to opt in, maybe we should allow communities to put an opt-in. But at this point, the current law is Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb. So if there are communities that want to talk about it, sure, they could talk about it. But I have yet to hear any communities come forward and say they want to be in. So it's a little hard to talk about hypotheticals. It's simply about maintaining that voice. And those residents would still, you know, if that community opted, you know, the community doesn't have to, the local council board does not have to put this up. This is a resolution that they put up for a vote. They don't have to put it up. It's an option for them. And I believe in choice and personal responsibility and giving local governments some options.
Representative Jeff Yarek, District 33, thank you very much for talking with us about this. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. You have a great day.
Coming up, Michigan prepares for the new coronavirus, also known as COVID-19. We'll talk with the state's chief medical executive next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The new coronavirus has yet to make a confirmed appearance in Michigan. We've said this before, your more immediate health risk is probably the flu, and yet the CDC has warned the public to prepare for a coronavirus outbreak. We were wondering what exactly that means. Dr. Janae Khaldun has agreed to come help explain. She's the state's chief deputy director for health and chief medical executive. Dr. Khaldun, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
What does it mean to prepare for the coronavirus? I mean, what does that look like for a state? Is it different than being ready for flu season?
So you're right. So a lot of the things that we would normally do to prepare for the flu is the same things that we're doing to prepare for the coronavirus. As you mentioned, we have not had any confirmed cases in the state of Michigan so far, but there's still a concern. There have been over 81,000 cases across the globe, primarily in China, and there have been also 14 travel-related cases in the United States. So what we're saying is we need to do everything we can to be prepared, and that's what we're doing with our public health system response.
But does that mean, in terms of the state, considering that there's no vaccine and that the treatment of coronavirus is sort of an evolving concept, what does it mean in terms of, you know, the state's health resources, for example?
So what we've been doing is actually working with our local public health departments and our health systems to make sure they're prepared. You're right, there is no vaccine. There's currently no treatment. So what we're moving towards is something called community mitigation. And it's a tool, basically, that public health uses regularly. For example, if there's a response to a chickenpox outbreak in a school, or if a hospital implements visitor restrictions during flu season, which many have already this year. Those are the types of things that we will be working on. So making sure we are ready if
coronavirus does come to the state, to do things like make sure we may need to close a school if a case comes through a school. We want to make sure everyone knows proper hygiene practices, such as washing their hands and sneezing into their sleeve and staying home if they're sick. Those are the types of efforts that we have been preparing for several weeks.
Is risk necessarily limited to places in Michigan that have large workplaces or large schools and school districts?
No, this is not limited. I think there's a role everyone can play, absolutely, in public health and being prepared. And again, these simple things I'm talking about, washing hands, not coming to work if you're sick, those are things everyone can do to be prepared, not only for the coronavirus, but also for flu, cold, and other viruses that we would normally see across the United States.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what large institutions should be doing to prepare outside of the sort of the formal medical system?
Yeah, so everyone should be looking at their human resource policies, updating them, including if people will be allowed to work from home and what that will look like, making sure everyone, again, knows stay home if you are sick. Make sure you wash your hands. Everyone should be making sure they're appropriately cleaning their common areas, so their lounges and their bathrooms. Again, these are really things from a public health perspective that organizations should be doing anyway, but this is the perfect time to dust those off, to make sure they're updated, and to make sure all of your employees are ready and prepared and know what to do.
It's funny. I think we don't often talk about custodial things, but, you know, in terms of public places, that does sound key. How far is the state prepared to go into this unknown field of preparation? I mean, in China, which is admittedly a very different situation, they're actually building new hospitals to deal with this. How far should the state go? How much of an investment is appropriate, do you think, at this time?
I mean, we will do whatever it takes, really, to slow the spread. And let me be very clear. The goal, if this becomes something that comes to Michigan, it will not be to 100% stop the spread, but it will be to slow the spread as much as possible. And so we'll be working with our local partners to make sure we're doing everything we can to do that. So that may include working with local school districts if and when they may need to close, working with our medical providers. So we will do whatever it takes. And like we always do in public health, we will pivot as necessary to protect the public's health.
Who is going to be in charge of containment? When we're talking about tracking down interactions with infected people, is that something that happens at the county level, or is the state in charge of that?
So we've actually already, for several weeks now, actually been working with our local health departments. So people who are coming with recent travel to mainland China, they are already, you know, going to their homes, coming through the Detroit Metro Airport, and we get their names and we send them to the local health departments for what we call self-quarantine or monitoring at home with the support of the local health department. So that is already happening. And will continue to happen. We are not currently quarantining anyone in a separate facility outside of their home. And again, we will pivot if this comes to the state of Michigan. But right now, we are not planning any mass quarantine situations. And again, it will become more of what we do in response to the flu. And like I said, chicken pox and measles and other things. Again, this is bread and butter public health. We have many experts in our state and our local health departments who have responded to other outbreaks in the past. And so we are ready and prepared to pivot as we need to address coronavirus if it comes to the state of Michigan.
I heard somebody at the CDC say it's not as if there isn't a playbook for such things. The CDC also said, though, to prepare for massive disruption of daily life. What does that look like in Michigan?
I'm not sure if there will be a massive disruption. Again, it could be just like if we have an outbreak of flu at a school. Yes, it may be that there are some places where employees are not coming to work, and so perhaps that particular business may decide to close. There may be times where we have a cluster at a school, and then that school may need to close. But again, these are things that the public health system
does anyway. It's often in the background and people don't hear about it. But these are tools that we have in our toolbox and we use on a regular basis, and we are prepared to use them if COVID-19 comes to Michigan.
Dr. Khaldun, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Michigan's Chief Medical Executive, Dr. Janae Khaldun. There's plenty to think about when you start considering all the interactions you have with others every day, every point of contact. With us now for a bit more information is Dr. Preethi Malani. Her field is infectious diseases, and she is the Chief Health Officer at the University of Michigan. Dr. Malani, welcome.
Thank you.
I confess, I keep walking around in public places wondering, possibly obsessively, if people have washed their hands. Am I on the right track?
You are. And hand washing is probably the most fundamental thing we can do to prevent all infections.
There are a number of public places where you can see people wearing masks already. I was at DTW the other day, and I saw people both coming and going wearing them. Is that something you recommend?
So the issues around the masks, they are not recommended for general use in terms of infection prevention. They do have a particular role within the health setting. But in fact, right now, there are some shortages on masks. So the recommendation is not to just wear them out and about.
Who do you consider most at risk right now within the field of your job? Are you thinking about students or patients or staff?
So we're talking about in context of coronavirus and not seasonal flu, which is also very active right now. And so far, we are still thinking, at least in the United States, travel is a big risk factor. And it had been travel really to China, and then Korea got added, Japan, cruise ships, and now potentially other parts of Europe, Italy, Iran. So it is becoming much more of a worldwide phenomena. But at this point, travel or exposure to somebody who may have been infected or exposed.
There's nothing quite like having a coughing fit in the midst of an interview about infectious disease. I hope you will pardon me. You have an entire community that you look after, you know, a whole university and one of the larger ones. How do you begin to craft a plan to think about protecting tens of thousands of people against something that is still largely an unknown commodity?
Yeah, so when we think about the university, we do think about various groups. So a lot of people think about the students, but we also have a very large staff and, of course, our faculty. In fact, we're the largest employer in the state. So it's a lot of people, and they're in a lot of places beyond central campus. When we think about preparing for coronavirus or really any other infectious threat or really any other disruption, we sort of break things down a bit. The health system has its own set of issues that they have to deal with in terms of preparing, and a lot of that work is built upon work that's been done for years around Ebola and SARS and H1N1. And there are a number of really important discussions happening at the health system. More particular to campus, it's the University Health Service, which, of course, is the front line for a lot of students who may be coming from places where they might have been exposed. So really thinking carefully about screening protocols, asking travel histories, and just making sure that we're really in close touch with our public health colleagues. So some of that is done. When we think at a broader level, there's also a lot of operations at the university. And so when we think about disruptions, and last year there were a couple weather days. If you remember, it was very cold, and so the university closed down. But that doesn't mean you don't have to feed people and house people and keep the lights going and taking care of animals. So thinking about continuity of operations is a big aspect of this, and it's an opportunity to really think deeply about what are the essential things of each unit, what would happen if you had to cut back on things, what are the plans? Like what's essential, what's not essential, and what would you do in a setting where things might be disrupted? So we've asked people to really take a good look at their continuity plans, and this isn't something that we have thought about in the last 2 weeks. It's been an ongoing process to really get people to get these written plans and to talk about continuity.
It sounds a lot like some of the public health disaster planning that you see in states that, you know, are at risk of earthquake or seismic activity or tornado seasons.
Absolutely. And I've shared with some of my colleagues that it's a little hard to predict what's going to happen in terms of coronavirus and is it going to come here and in what fashion and when. But it is probably the best example we have is weather-related disruption. And sometimes that's a little bit predictable with a hurricane, but sometimes it's not, like with a tornado. And Michigan, fortunately, is a little bit protected from those major weather disasters. So this could be new territory for some.
At what point would you say the meetings and conversations about coronavirus really picked up speed?
So I would say probably in mid-January, we started thinking about it a bit. And really one of the first things we did, not so much because we had a concern for infection immediately happening on our campus, was because we're a global university and we have a lot of students, faculty, and even staff that are all over the world, is really taking a look at who is in China, what's their status, are they okay, should we help them get home, and then I think also looking ahead to future travel. So there have been a number of programs that got delayed, postponed, rescheduled, moved somewhere else, and at this point it's just an unknown, even looking into the fall. So thinking about enrollment and how things might get impacted.
I saw today travel to South Korea is the latest aspect of that to be adjusted, that
yes.
There won't be any travel to South Korea for university personnel for the foreseeable future.
That's correct.
How much about this is communication for you? I mean, there's communication with staff and faculty, but there's also the student body, this
yes.
population that might not always be clued into what the administration's talking about.
Yeah, and I think we try to use a lot of different approaches to communication, and there's sort of the old-fashioned newspaper and radio and other things, but the students communicate in really different ways, and they communicate sometimes in very informal ways. So making sure that there's good information in the places that they are and not forgetting what the day-to-day issues are around seasonal flu, because you have people in close contact. And I think trying to be a voice of reason, but also saying, listen, make sure that if you're traveling, for example, spring break is around the corner, and thinking ahead about having a plan in case you get stuck, thinking ahead, just being smart, paying attention.
Boy, you're not kidding when you talk about spread of information. I have a school-age kid at home, lower elementary, and I was very shocked to learn that this is a topic on the playground. Kids talking with not the best information at their disposal about methods of transmission. Is that a concern among the rest of us as well?
It is. And I think, again, if you rely only on social media for information, it can be questionable in terms of accuracy, because there's a lot of conspiracy theories and other issues around this. And to be honest, there are a lot of unknowns, including whether the spreads from people who are asymptomatic. That's not quite clear. Does it spread in other ways other than respiratory routes?
Michigan's home to world-class medical facilities, like the University Hospital. What can these hospitals do to limit risk of new contagion?
Well, within the hospital, there are a number of policies. I think first thing is just identifying someone who might be at risk and quickly putting them in a place where they would be safe, and making sure that our healthcare workers have good awareness and personal protective equipment and really good knowledge on how to use it and how to use it properly, and making sure they have adequate access.
Is there a clear decision-making process for whether the university should consider closing certain facilities or maybe even an entire campus?
Well, there are policies in place, and those are discussions that would be had at a very high level and really weighing pros and cons. And in this case, in terms of infection issues, being hand-in-hand with our public health colleagues.
What else is on your mind just as you think about your own mindfulness about this and staying healthy?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a time to really, like, think about being well and not worrying so much about something to the point where you're not able to function well. Again, I think there are a couple of really important lessons. One is register your travel. We find that a lot of people who are traveling on university business are not taking that small step to register their travel. Having a good plan for any kind of disruption at home, too.
U of M Chief Health Officer Dr. Preethi Malani, thank you so much for taking some time to stop in.
Thank you.
Today's Ash Wednesday, first day of Lent. If you grew up going to a Christian church, you might remember the Bible verses. Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return. St. Clair's Episcopal in Ann Arbor wanted to make sure that even the busiest of believers could partake in Ash Wednesday.
And so we know that people with their busy lives cannot always get to church or mass to get the ashes. So we want to take the ashes and take Jesus to the people on the streets.
Kelly Hsu is a deacon intern at St. Clair's Episcopal, and for a couple hours this morning, she was in the cold, snowy weather with a sign nearby that read, "Ashes to Go."
And we served ashes to go to 19 people. And people were so moved and so appreciative that they had the opportunity to receive the ashes during their busy life. Lots of honks, lots of waves.
St. Clair's is not the first church to do this, but Choi says it is a way to keep folks connected if they wish.
This has been a part of the Episcopal Church thinking outside the box. We know not everybody even goes to church or has been hurt by the church, but still has their spiritual devotions to their past traditions. And so we thought, let's meet people on the street where they're at.
Well, here at Stateside, home to several very bad Catholics, myself included, we heartily endorse this method. Please, folks, just don't text and genuflect and drive at the same time. Next on Stateside, we explore Detroit's musical history beyond Motown.
It started with the doo-wops, you know, and I was standing on the corner trying to harmonize with the guys at school, and that's how it all started. You know, it starts from the heart.
We'll explore less-known but vibrant labels that churned out soul classics. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. February is Black History Month, and we're exploring artists of many different kinds. But this week, we wanted to dive into Michigan music history. I know, Detroit, right? But we decided to go beyond Motown to talk about all the working artists playing in clubs and dances and truly making the culture that is Detroit. Melvin Davis, the singer known in soul circles as Detroit's soul ambassador, is our guest today. A resident of the city since 1945, he played with everyone from Smokey Robinson to David Ruffin to Wayne Kramer, and is a solo artist in his own right. We also invited Dan Austin, history buff, DJ, and host of the Motor City Soul Club. Dan spent years tracking down songs and stories. I started out by asking Melvin how music became an influence in his life.
You know, music, I like to say, is the soundtrack of life.
I first met you. You were just another girl.
So no matter what situation you're involved in, whether you're at war, whether you're getting married, whether you're angry, whether you're happy, whether you're celebrating, whether you're disappointed, music, there's a song for everything. And it touches us in ways that words and actions just couldn't.
And was that how it was in your home when you were growing up?
Oh yeah, there was always music, always.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, my mom, she's passed away now for 12 years, but every single morning, the first thing she'd do when she'd get up before she even started breakfast would turn the radio on.
What was she listening to?
Oh, you know, like rhythm and blues, the usual shows that bring the popular music to the public.
And were there bands in town that she knew of or that she would play for you?
Well, her and my dad, they used to go to the Paradise. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
I'd certainly heard of it.
Yeah, well, it was a place where all the top acts from Lionel Hampton, Duke Ellington, and her and my dad would occasionally go down there.
How did this become a professional concern for you?
Well, that's a good question because it's sort of, I like to say I do music, but music does me. And it was a bug. I always loved music when I was young. I had a great sense of rhythm that I wasn't even aware of, but I just knew that I was a great dancer. I could ham bone my butt off. And, later on, it started with the doo-wops, you know, and I was standing on the corner trying to harmonize with the guys at school in the bathroom where the great reverberation and you had a natural echo chamber.
Best acoustics. And,
yeah.
Say, man. You're looking downhearted, trying hard to make it, and you just can't seem to get started.
And that's how it all started. You know, it starts from the heart. The music business and music are two entirely different things.
Of course.
Without a doubt. I love music with all my heart. The business, Take it or leave it, rather leave it.
Were there artists that you looked up to as you were beginning to play and beginning to do gigs?
I think everyone has their idols, everyone. And I loved great songs, and my favorite male artist was Jackie Wilson, and still is.
Your love lifting me higher than I've ever been lifted before. So keep it.
And my favorite female artist is Etta James. They just had a vibrational presence in their voices that just penetrates your soul. There are so many nuances that happens in a singer's voice that so many people aren't really aware of. Just how they end notes and, you know, the energy that they put on each syllable. Jackie Wilson was an amazing, amazing individual.
I know that the music business can be intensely competitive, but were there artists who you both were impressed with and also you considered colleagues or peers?
Well, you know, when you just said competitive, that's something that's very important because that's one thing about Detroit, the competition. It's part of what made Detroit so dynamic and such a phenomenal music mecca. And I like to use the line that competition creates excellence because it does.
It's often said by local artists that Detroit has the toughest audiences and maybe the toughest critics too. Melvin, did you find that to be the case back in the 1960s?
Absolutely. Yeah? Absolutely. The competition was fierce. And that competition created excellence. And I think if I had been in another city, if I was in another city, I wouldn't be this Melvin Davis because I was influenced by and encouraged by so many great musicians and singers and producers. You know, I mean, if you think that your stuff is the greatest, then you know, you got the wrong attitude. People will tell you what it is. You don't have to, oh, this is going to be the biggest hit, and then you'll be disappointed because it won't be. And then the great musicians like James Jamerson, Earl Van Dyke, the great drummers, Pistol Allen, Benny Benjamin, they were not like snobbish people. And that gave me the energy and the confidence to go on. If James Jamerson says it's good, well, I'm never going to stop.
Was there a moment when you knew that something special was happening with all those different personalities and people coming together?
Oh, absolutely. The energy lets you know because anytime something that you just can't get away from. You know, I ate, slept, and everything I did was music. If I was awake, I was doing music. If I was asleep, I was dreaming about it. Music and girls. And with that, I'll let Dan, comment on that because knowing Dan Awesome the way that I do, he has been really touched and influenced by Detroit's music scene. And I just wonder, Dan, at what age did you start becoming fascinated and really interested in music and realizing that it was going to be a part of your life for the rest of your days?
Probably when I was like 8 or 9, but it wasn't until I was late teens, early 20s that I got to the good stuff. For me, it was weird because I've always had even though I grew up in the suburbs, unfortunately, I've always had a tremendous amount of Detroit pride. So for me, it was more about digging into Detroit's musical heritage and trying to discover all of these artists. And it just so happens that a lot of them are really, really good. I mean, there are people all over the world who are, you know, they honor, they revere, if not worship, people like Melvin. I mean, Melvin can play in front of a couple hundred people here in Detroit at the Lager House, but he goes overseas and he's playing in front of thousands of people. And so it's for me, there's always been this push to try to get Detroiters, Metro Detroiters, Michiganders, to appreciate what it is that we export to the rest of the world. And I don't feel like people here really get it. It is such an honor to have people like Melvin who are still performing right here in our own backyards. And I think it's great whenever you just are walking down the street and you bump into, I don't know, Willie Kendrick or somebody. And,
yeah.
You know, he's just sitting there drinking coffee, people watching in the Fisher Building because, you know, he's just a regular guy.
I mean, to me, the reason that scenario is a reality is because we have so much talent.
Just literally on every block.
On every block. And yeah. I think that's why it's not revered the way that it is in other countries and in other cities. It's because you're just too close to it.
Yeah, we have too much of it. You take it for granted, I think. I mean, it's not just soul music. Obviously, there's Motown, but you know, Melvin is one of hundreds of artists from Detroit in the 1960s who put out music every bit as good as what was coming out of Hitsville Studios. They just didn't sell as many copies.
We've been talking today with Dan Austin, DJ and host of the Motor City Soul Club, and also with Melvin Davis, Detroit's soul ambassador. Dan, there's a lot of music. Who comes to your mind when you think about music that people don't realize was made that didn't come out of Motown proper?
Man, well, I mean, I think Aretha Franklin is probably the biggest one. I mean, Aretha was not a Motown artist, but a lot of people associate her with it.
You're no good, heartbreaker, a liar and a cheat. And I don't know why I let you do these things to me.
Jackie Wilson, for an older crowd, I mean, Jackie Wilson died in 1984. He was in a coma for 10 years before that, so there was a long period where, you know, people might know Higher and Higher or some of his bigger hits, Lonely Teardrops, but he's not on the same cusp as Aretha. There are lots of artists from Detroit who might not be huge locally, but I mean overseas, my goodness. I mean you go into YouTube and you punch in Melvin Davis, I Must Love You, and it's got, you know, whatever, million plays. So the music might not be known here in Detroit, but it's certainly known all over the world.
So the record industry was a fledgling industry at that time. And I like to talk about United Sound because we had one of the best recording facilities, well, on the Eastern Seaboard. You had to go to New York to get a better sound than you would achieve at United Sound. United Sound allowed 300 fledgling record labels to participate in the music industry.
That's a lot of songs.
That's a lot of songs, and that's a lot of participation.
What was it like, you know, playing shows or for other aspects of the business for those artists who were not working on Motown or the Tamla label?
One of the main ingredients in the success of Detroit's music history is opportunity. So opportunity was everywhere. And I think that was caused by other ingredients, like the fact that there was the auto industry, there was upper movement.
Ha! What you see is what you get. Is what you get. What you see is what you get. Is what you get.
And they had the money to go out and support these different clubs and bars and situations, and the schools had sock hops and the DJs. See, one thing about Detroit, without the DJs, how would you get your music to the marketplace? How would anybody even hear it?
Right.
You know, we talk about Motown, and that's a great thing. I'm so proud of them. That's our crowning glory. I work with Motown as a studio, actually as a road drummer. I was Smokey Robinson's drummer for 2.5 years. I was the Temptations' first drummer. I played for Martha Reeves. I played for the Originals. So I was a staff drummer at Motown. So I'm very proud of their accomplishments, of course. But what happened outside of Motown only would enhance Motown. And it should never, you know, negate the contributions that people like myself have made. It just shouldn't.
I was just going to jump in there real quick and say, and that's kind of what the Motor City Soul Club is all about, is that we don't play, you know, you're not going to hear Baby Love at one of our events or one of our podcasts because everybody knows that song. They've heard it a million times. Our whole thing is about trying to introduce people to music that has been forgotten, at least here in Detroit. We want someone to walk out of that show saying, I have no idea how I've lived my entire life to this point without having heard that song. You know, and get people out there, not necessarily record collecting, but just being turned on to a new old sound.
Before we leave the, you know, the golden age, I wanted to just ask you if you have any memories of what happened to the music industry in Detroit, what was going on in the scene when Motown moved to Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, you know, music is a moving thing. And what's in style right now will not be in style a few years from now. Every generation has to have their own identity. So Motown was on the verge of not being the top shelf dominant force in the music industry that it was in the 60s. In the late 60s, the whole psychedelic thing was coming along. You know, the whole rock scene with Hendrix and, you know, that whole scene was changing. The music was expanding and growing. You had Sly and the Family Stone. The style of music, you know, it's supposed to do that. But just like with everything in the music industry, the variety gets circumvented when they want to, you know, put it into like a commercial form, because then it stops growing.
When markets decide that it's time
exactly.
for something else.
So I think that's what happened. You know, like at the end of the 60s, Motown had run its course, so to speak. It was a course like no other in history, but it wasn't going to be forever, like nothing is forever. Nothing. They had a great turn.
Gentlemen, I have one last question for you. We are 50 and sometimes 60 years removed from a lot of this history. How important is it to you to catalog these songs and stories and recognize these artists while they're still with us?
Well, I think this is very important because it is the history of the city. And for other countries to utilize our history to create harmony and unity in their communities, why in the world can't we have that in the city where it was created?
I know I'm biased, but in my opinion, there will never be better music created ever. You know, we're moving into this era of auto-tune and computer sampling and everything. These are incredible arrangements, incredible songwriting. The competition that Melvin was talking about was driving folks like nothing we've ever seen. And it wasn't about making a lot of money. It was about just making good music.
Bringing joy and setting the style for the entire planet.
Yeah, so if we lose it, I mean, we're losing perhaps the most creative era of music ever. Yeah, like I said, it'll never be matched. But I feel like Detroit being the hub of creativity, a vision of art that it is, I think that in this city, our past always influences our future.
And Motown is extremely important, and it should be. It's the crowning glory. But when you start to dig into the vast roots that are buried here in the city, it only enhances Motown, and it makes the story so much more interesting and so much bigger.
Melvin Davis, Detroit's own soul ambassador. We've also been talking today with Dan Austin, who you can find out and about hosting the Motor City Soul Club. Gentlemen, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for making a little time for us.
For me, it's been an honor and a pleasure, and any time at all. Thank you. And Detroit, soul, rock and roll, rhythm and blues. Keep on dancing.
We're going to go out today on Melvin's song, Find a Quiet Place and Be Lonely.
A clean original vinyl pressing of this one is retailing for about $1,800. That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. Hey!